How has Canada's arts and culture industry adapted since the pandemic? Or has it? Considering the current state of inflation and economic instability, what unique revenue generation challenges are arts organizations facing now? And what are some key trends to adapt to? Hello and welcome to the 10th episode of At the Mic, Au Micro, a podcast brought to you by Arts Consultants Canada, l'Association des Consultants Canadiens en Art. ACCA acknowledges the support of the Canada Council for the Arts for this podcast series. Nous remercions le Conseil des Arts du Canada pour son soutien à cette série du balado. In this episode of At the Mic, consultants Ben Detchy and Sue Edworthy talk about today's challenges of revenue generation and audience engagement. Now, this is not another pandemic conversation, but rather an exploration of innovative current and future approaches to revenue development and diversification, looking at virtual events and online platforms, collaboration with other sectors, the preferences of younger audiences, and the ever-evolving financial and artistic landscape, all without ever using the word pivot. Ben Detchy is a senior consultant with the Davos Institute of Arts Management, supporting a diverse array of organizations to achieve short and long-term goals in the areas of strategic planning, artistic planning, marketing, fundraising, change management, and community engagement. Since joining the Institute, Ben has led or assisted over 50 strategic planning processes, conducted regional arts ecology studies, and served as advisor to over 30 organizations. Some recent clients include the Yale Schwarzman Center in New Haven, the Wexner Center for the Arts in Columbus, STEP Africa in Washington, D.C., Museo d'Arte de Puerto Rico, the Ellis Marcellus Center for Music in New Orleans, and Kentucky Shakespeare in Louisville. Now, prior to joining the Institute, Ben was Executive Director of Soundstreams, Canada's leading contemporary music and opera producer. During his tenure, the organization expanded revenues by 67% to support more staged opera and immersive performances, and launched an ambitious international touring program and transformed its brand to reach new audiences. Ben's arts management ethos runs on formative years as a saxophonist and composer, performing and recording across North America and Europe. Sue Edworthy has worked in the nonprofit performing arts field for over 20 years, with stints as a director, event coordinator, and arts administrator. She's now in demand as a consultant, speaker, and facilitator, and has run over 75 workshops on marketing, social media, and branding, including the inaugural Work and Culture Marketing Masterclass. In addition, Sue provides counsel, solutions, and support for individual artists and arts organizations in areas such as marketing, branding, strategic planning, mentorship, and facilitation. Sue is a former board member for Toronto Alliance for Performing Arts, was co-chair for Arts Vote, and spent 7 years on the board of the Toronto Fringe Festival. She's a recipient of a Herald Award and the Leonard McCarty and John Harvey Award for Excellence in Arts Administration. And now, here are Ben Detchy and Sue Edworthy.
Hey, Ben.
Hi, Sue.
I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. Why don't we get started? Tell me very quickly, why did you want to do this podcast?
Yeah, you know, I think these conversations are important. And I think it's great that there's something like this in Canada where we're putting our heads together and trying to think about what's happening and in real time unpack that. And I always welcome the chance to have a meeting of minds of folks that are thinking about these things day to day.
So let's dive in, shall we?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So we're near the end of 2023 and we're coming up on 4 years after the world changed in an unimaginable way.
Ugh, it's 4 years already. Wow.
Right? I saw a meme the other day that said, you know, in 4 months, 2019, the good times will be 5 years ago, and I don't know how to process that. But as we're approaching the end of 2023, how do you think the arts and culture industry adapted since the pandemic?
You know, I was for a long time working on this theory that if we would just wait for the same amount of time we were sort of in the lockdowns, and the disruption, that would be an important time at which we could measure how things were going on the other end. In other words, wait just as long for the recovery as we did for the disruption. It seems like we've come up on that time limit or about to. and things are not, of course, as they were before. So there's ways that we're adapting, and there's ways that maybe we're not adapting as quickly as we probably should be. I do think that really this was an acceleration of trends that were already in play, if we really think about it, right? We know that it was not normal to have our business disrupted and upheld for all that time, but the substitutes in the digital realm that are entering into this space to take people's time and money that we would like to have be a part of our organization were very much in play before this. And I think really the headline for me is that this has been a time that accelerated that and perhaps got us even more on the back foot than we were in 2019 to understand how we fit into the lives of people who have an ever more vibrant array of very high quality, very cheap things that they can do without leaving their home. So, you know, it's interesting to think about it as an adaption. I think it's an adaption to the big, big long-term trend as well as the pandemic, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. I'll definitely be coming back to that in a bit. People can't see, but you can see me nodding my head emphatically. So, and I guess the way I think about it is, as I said, you know, because at the start of the pandemic, so many donation requests were being met. You know, people, we were just throwing as much money as we could at GoFundMes and at Charity Canada Helps and to keep the doors open on these places because their money was no longer there. And then there was, you know, CERB for individuals, and there was CEBA for organizations and business grants from the Ontario government. And just sort of this influx of cash that may or may not have fixed everything, but there was a way to pay people at least and get some work done. And now if you Google those things, which I did this morning, it's got words like closed and repayment and interest, right? And so if you factor that into our current state of inflation and economic instability, I mean, what unique revenue generation challenges are arts organizations facing right now?
Yeah. It's a great question. You know, we had to do things the way we had to do them, but just as it is for the broader economy and any other industry, all of those supports were a distortion, right? They allowed us to continue without perhaps the greatest measure that we need to rely on being present, that being engagement. Philanthropy is absolutely a function of engagement at a certain point in time. And we've really come to the end of that period where we can rely on, you know, the goodwill of our institutional families without them feeling a deep connection to the organization, without them having an ongoing and active place for the work that we do in their lives. We know, of course, anecdotally that audiences are still down, quote unquote, at least compared to the 2019 watermark that we've all used so much. The data always comes in as a lagging indicator. You know, I know that Capicoa is basically saying that we are in the after times now. Whatever we see now in terms of daylight between the before and now is really got to be seen as an ongoing condition to work with. And they're seeing that sort of the real GDP output or the productivity output of the arts sector is at about 95% of pre-pandemic. I think that would be a very different number if we surveyed our audiences like they do in the States. The NEA's huge audience survey that only happens once every almost 10 years, I think. 2017 was the last one. They're saying that 48% of people attended at least one arts and culture event between July 2021 and July 2022. And that's down like 6%. Yeah, it's a shocking statistic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's including, you know, formats that are large festivals and very popular things, not just sort of niche offerings.
In high school, that's a failing grade. It's a failure. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, all that is to say, to your earlier point, we've really got to think about rebuilding that family. What can we do to really build out from the middle those that are really engaged in our work and do that good work of audience development and development of our supporters one step at a time and really think about how we can recover in that way? The monetary belt is tightening because we've, in many cases, lost touch with our marginal audiences, I think.
Here's a question, because I remember, I think maybe like 2 weeks in, you know, where we all thought it was going to be, oh, it's only 2 weeks and we get to stay home from work and let's order cookies to celebrate, you know, and talking to so many people who worked in the arts who I knew. And so the main question on everyone's mind was, what's it going to be like? What's it going to be like? What do you think it's going to be like? And I had to say, I said, at this point, it's going to be like trying to smell the color nine. Like, there's no idea what it's going to be like. And so that sort of, that impetus to rush and fix it and fill something and prepare for something that we could not have, well, we could have, we won't get into that, but we could not have dreamt what happened to us, right? And so what, we've got the challenges that you just laid out. What are its organizations doing to respond to these challenges?
Yeah, sure. And maybe we can think about that in terms of really right now, what are they doing? Because I do think you alluded to a pretty reactionary period in which everyone was scrambling to find solutions in all industries, including the arts. And there was a deluge of content online that was really not very high quality, if we can be honest and direct about it. And that's entering a marketplace that's absolutely saturated, right? So that is not the way forward. I really think that I still feel often the online productions and online content is misviewed by many of arts and culture organizations I'm working with. Monetization is really, really difficult. And so its potential can be overstated sometimes, particularly by boards. I love boards, but particularly by boards, they might be excited to see their geographic reach suddenly expand to be global. But we've got to think about what the relationship with the customer is and what it means over time. And
is the one guy in Belgium? Yeah. Gotcha.
Exactly that.
All right, fine.
Is that person in Belgium, a millionaire donor? Probably not. Maybe. No, of course not.
I always would say, you know, you have to remember we're putting up these videos, you know, well, maybe it'll go viral. We're not Taylor Swift.
We're not Taylor Swift. Yeah, exactly. Like, knowing that you're a niche product and really understanding the power of that is absolutely great advice. I would agree with you completely there. Not that we don't always want to build out our audiences, but how often is it really that we haven't done the engagement with our existing audience to deepen their relationship? That's always the first place to go. And so it does fit with this bigger question about online content. I've basically been saying this whole time that the online move to put everything up is really catching up content marketing in the arts, you know, that we're quite behind other industries in terms of embracing content marketing. And so if we can think about creating a relationship with people by giving them something really compelling to extend the relationship they have with us into their home, but really understanding that what we do first and foremost is provide a really incredible, very niche in-person experience and try to make sure that we're cultivating people to seek that out ever more. I think that's a good place to think about digital.
You and I are on the same page about this, absolutely. Because I know I watch so many shows, theater shows on video, and great performances from great people, and Gillian Anderson as Blanche DuBois. It's not the same. I don't care how many cameras you have. It's not the same as, you know, that study they did where they realized when people sit in a room together to experience something like that, their heartbeats sync up. You don't get that sitting at home, right?
Right. So the real question is what to do with all of that, given that, you know, we are seeing less and less of these in-person engagement. And this isn't just in the arts, right? Yeah. People are starting to tailor their lives more to the online. So really, if we cut through the pandemic and pretend it didn't happen, which would just be nice in general, we might still see that we're grappling with that, right?
So how are institutions diversifying their revenue stream? Because we've established that many wells have gone dry, because people and institutions gave so much during the pandemic. Now, what do we do?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about it on the revenue side. There's always the expense side, but today's topic is revenue. So here we go. You know, I think one area to look at that's interesting is the organizations are often the keepers of some pretty special intellectual property or expertise, and maybe they haven't actually thought about all the ways they could monetize that. This could be, I mean, it's not just because I'm a consultant that I'm saying it could be consulting, but it's, you know, for example, I think it's the Brooklyn Youth Chorus, if I'm remembering correctly, that has a sort of proprietary conducting method that they've developed over time. And because they were able to codify that and really have it as a calling card, they now sell that as a workshop to other choral conductors of various degrees in their career. So that's one way that they've been able to create an ongoing revenue stream that's truly diverse compared to everything else they're doing. I also think just thinking about private sector partnerships more dynamically, I think about Nightwood Theatre here in Toronto and their lawyer show, which has been successful for, right? Like, it's like, okay, what do we have in-house that's really special that would be valued by other parties. And that's a very mission-driven effort, isn't it? Where they have lawyers come and participate with them for a long period of time, like I think it's a half year or something like that,
yes,
and a show at the end. And it's also under the guise of professional development, right? Because lawyers want to be good public speakers, and obviously they are people that are well lent to that. So there's this synergy of the two sort of mission thrusts coming together. There's probably more opportunities like that if we can sort of see outside of our bubbles of our organization and think about it, you know?
Everyone gets back to work tomorrow. Who has first aid training? We yeah. need to sell that, right? Who wants to be the fire marshal, right?
Yeah, yeah. Put it all on the table. Yeah, that's right.
And I guess if we talk about that, if we go back to the idea of revenue generation and videos are not videos and in person or not person, and you think about pricing strategies, because those are the two things we think about, and we have to think about the whole bigger picture of what are people actually spending their money on these days, and are we part of that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just saw an article in The Economist the other day that really made it clear that people are not spending on services as much as they used to before the pandemic. Services, including experiences like ours, right? So we just want to recognize first that there's a bit of a headwind right now for that in general. I don't know, and no one knows if that's going to continue. But that huge swell of I'd rather renovate my house than do anything outside of it is still kind of there. So in the arts, I think we should recognize that first.
Yeah.
And then with pricing, I mean, we have to do what every other industry is doing, and we have to increase prices according to inflation, or at least try. Corporate America and Canada have been able to pass on all of the costs of inflation through to the consumer, which is actually really annoying. We all felt that at the grocery store. So I just think in the arts sometimes, it's important for us to remember we can only sort of fix the part of the world that is within our sphere of influence. And I would like not for the arts to hurt in this time more by not sort of thinking about pricing along with the rest of the world. So what I have seen is, you know, there's examples like Beyonce and Taylor Swift where the prices are exceeding inflation in their increase. And there's that sort of effect we've talked about in the big media and all that. But when it comes to arts institutions, it's really only some of the big ones, some of the big museums, for example, that are actually increasing their rates to keep pace with inflation. And then in the smaller and mid-sized arts organizations, I'm seeing like no increases generally. You know, I'm sure there's exceptions to that rule, but I do think it's time to start looking at that. And lastly, just really think about who's price sensitive, right? I mean, you've got probably a couple of bands in your ticket prices that aren't very price sensitive, and you could absolutely introduce that increase, particularly as, you know, we haven't been quote unquote back for all that long, whereas you're going to have to be really careful at the bottom end of your price spectrum to make sure that you're holding that price during a time when people have less and less discretionary income to make sure you're not, you know, leaving anyone out in the cold.
It's one of those sort of ad nauseum discussions where it's like, well, what makes us worth it? What makes us worth a $45, a $65, $110 ticket? What makes it, and the, you know, poor examples, people say, well, people are buying Taylor Swift tickets. Yeah, but that's Taylor, right? You know, or people will pay, you know, $100 a month for cable. Yeah, 24/7 entertainment. So what makes us worth it? Because it's always that discussion of, you know, you're there in person, you're together, you could, you know, but then you could go for dinner and get a babysitter and pay for parking, and it becomes much, much more expensive. And I was telling a colleague of mine, we were talking about a ticket price for a show one day. She's like, that's pricey. I said, but here's the thing. They've got grants and sponsorships. This could be a lot more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that feeling of it's being subsidized, how much more do we need to subsidize it before we can say, you know what, this is how much it costs?
Yeah. This is a really interesting topic. I mean, we are sort of by design and we're tasked with being a little bit further along that spectrum of demand and maybe desire, if you will. We're here to introduce ideas into culture that are maybe not widely adopted as commercial at this point in time. But also one can easily imagine going too far in that direction where we're just not paying attention to creating that demand that we want to see for the work, even if it is introducing society to some new ideas. So what makes it worthwhile and what will? I mean, to use an overtired term, it's the experience economy. We have to think about, given the limited time and attention people have, given the increased costs and less disposable income, what is it that's going to be worthwhile that will be so distinctive in the array of activity that one can choose from within one's home or from within one's pocket device that it's going to stand out? And that, I think, means a lot of different things to different organizations. But it typically, to me, means we're thinking about the entire arc of the experience. before the show, what's being sent to me, how am I being spoken to, what's being shared in terms of content, how do I find this venue, how do I get there, is that all painless, is the front of house staff wonderful, do I feel a sense of community and belonging that makes me feel like I'm somewhere special, that's that sort of third space in my life, and then is, importantly, is the production amazing? Because if we're really honest, sometimes we just put work up that really, it's a sunk cost thing. It really didn't need to necessarily go up. We've got to be more careful about that kind of product right now, because we know that the really great shows are selling out. And we know that the things that are sort of the down the middle, regular run of the mill is not, right? So I think it would be a great time to think very carefully about programming and not just put things that are known or popular up all the time, but to be make sure they're absolutely the most compelling options, well-resourced, and perhaps at the expense of doing quite so much during a given year.
Really, really solid work instead of the traditional 8 shows and a fundraiser.
Exactly.
We're only doing 4 shows and they're on point.
Yeah. How differentiated is it? Is it really, truly excellent? Is it something that's going to stand out enough, not just from a marketing perspective, but from the actual experience afterwards, that people are going to say, that was worth it. Not, I feel cheated. I'd like my $70 back and my evening back that I could have watched a movie, you know, at home. Yeah.
It's funny because you mentioned the experience beforehand. I'm currently working with the Oakville Symphony, and the conductor and I decided that to create a series of videos for reels, for stories on Instagram, that are him explaining, when do I clap? Can I bring my drink inside? What do I wear? All of those questions that people don't want to ask because they feel foolish, asking such a basic question, quote unquote. But the conductor himself is telling you, yeah, wear your jeans, it's fine. You can totally bring your beer in. And that sort of feeling to say, you are welcome here, this is your symphony. We want you to be here, we want you to be comfortable, we want you to relax. So that pre-show stuff, I would say, from a marketing perspective, is just as important as the actual show itself. The concert's closed this weekend. I'm spending the week writing thank yous and surveys. That's what we're doing, right? Because that's part of it. So I liked this question you had. We're talking about changing consumer preferences, because we're talking about not being into going somewhere and seeing something and sitting there for 2 hours in silence watching it. There's a younger audience who does not believe in that. Believe, that sounds biblical. I don't mean it that way. There's a younger audience who is not accustomed to that. Then again, I also just created a rush seat for people under 35. So what is young now? Like youth was 29 when I was 28, right? Getting the grant to me for summer jobs. But youth has just sort of expanded. And I don't know how, what, you know, because when you all say, hey gang, we're on TikTok. No, you're not. You're not the right vibe, you know, that kind of thing. And how do we make our work speak to these younger audiences, be they 17 or 26 or 32, to make it worthwhile for them?
Mm-hmm.
That this is the thing you do.
Yeah, you know, wherever you want to put that goalpost of what is young or not, I think that, you know, the preferences of the younger generation are always a leading indicator for us, aren't they, about what we need to be thinking about for everyone, because who would have thought that everyone up to 90 would be on Facebook by now? And now, of course, young people often aren't. And so if we think about that, the first sort of hard truth I think we just don't deal with is that certain art forms may never actually appeal en masse to young people. There's a change that has to do with, I think, if you look back enough, the fact that the education system focused on a certain number of arts forms, and those were often because of a colonial background and import, and we thought they were important as a society. And of course, those are some of my absolute favorite art forms. So that's not my personal observation of value or anything like that. It's to say, look, if we've got culture moving forward in a certain way, what do we really think honestly about what was going to appeal and engage with that next generation? I looked at things like maybe even gaming and how huge that is now and how people are finding community and intense sense of engagement and commitments to these ever more elaborate online worlds. And that is in and of itself, strangely, sort of an art form. And what does that tell us? Not necessarily that we want to replace every symphony with video game concerts, but it might tell us about the type of thing that's engaging the mind of the future. Is it multisensory? Probably. Is it going to involve technology, even if technology is not central or complete in what the experience is? Yes, probably. Is it going to be something that I can step in and out of on demand rather than come to a certain geographic place at a specific time at a high ticket price? Probably. So that's what's so hard when you think about the classical arts is what do we want to do with that, right? How do we create things that are experiences that are aligned with that sort of sense of belonging and engagement that young people are looking for? It's probably going to mean the actual forms of our productions have to change. And I think that there's some excitement in what that could mean. And we're just beginning to uncover some of that. One of my good friends from Prague runs the Signal Festival, which is an enormous light festival that I think brings about 600,000 people to descend on the city. And you see any picture of that, and it is all ages and many, many young people. And it really is very artful. You know, it's a projection mapping on buildings that are just gorgeous and very contemporary installations. And I think we need to be imaginative about the actual forms themselves and the audience experience that comes with it.
So something we always hear is how crucial arts and culture are is to society, right? We are crucial. And does everyone else know this? For lack of, like, we have, you know, we have the numbers and we have the case studies and we have the memes about Mozart on Instagram. And is this a world we actually live in? And the reason I ask, I've been thinking about it, there's a great new site called Manifesto for Now. And their second essay asks the question, how has it come to pass that the arts and artists are not a central part of every financial, political, and social conversation? How did we become so niche, right? I mean, I think of a donor from a place I used to work at, you know, older, much older man at that point, but he and his wife fled persecution in Germany in the 30s. They got to Austria. The first thing they did was buy tickets to Don Giovanni that night. First thing they did. I don't think I'd do that, right? So it's that idea of how do we know what world we're living in, and how do we get up to speed with that?
Yeah. You know, I think there's probably two parts to that. And one is probably that we don't realize that other things have filled that space now. Because I think when we say arts, we mean a certain kind of arts created a certain kind of way. And we think about the difference between the world then and now, there are other things people turn to in order to fill that space. Are we going to participate in those modes or not? I think is a big question, right? Are we going to be that place that someone turns to online for community, for connection, and for expression? But then the other side of it, I think too, perhaps too romantically, that we ought to think about the role of artists in society more expansively again. The artist is thinker, the artist is integrated into social fabric. I think about the Yerba Buena Center in San Francisco that has these artists in residence that are sort of like thinkers in residence that are tasked to imagine creativity and creative solutions in their community, not just art making, but they had, for example, an urban food security initiative that was on for a while. So they're really trying to use creative practice as a way to imagine the world we want to live in and actually to play a hand in creating it. I mean, that's truly exciting to me. I think we could lean into that really hard. You know, thinking about a group I was working with in the pandemic that was using artists to create vaccine messaging because the health messaging was getting ignored and wasn't trusted by certain communities, rightfully so, perhaps. And in any case, they were able to get funding not from an arts agency, but from the health sector to do this
Amazing.
Work, you know? So really thinking about the social impact of art and how artists can participate in creating the world that we all want to live in is a really generative space, I think.
I'll say this very briefly. It's funny because I was thinking about our conversation the other night as I sat and watched The Medicis on Netflix and just admiring, you know, how Florence was so thriving and look and just come live here and I've got a studio for you. We'll pay for everything. But oh, why can't it be that way now as I sit at home watching The Medicis on Netflix? Oh, I just answered my question, didn't I? My favorite wrap-up question. What do you anticipate is the next big trend? I love asking that question. I feel like I'm on Entertainment Tonight or something. What's the new disruption, Ben? Tell us.
Oh, this is great. We can do some wild speculation. And then
yes.
If I'm right, we can just absolutely forefront that in 10 years. And if I'm wrong, we'll just bury it. Yeah.
All right. Yep.
Okay, so I think it's the entrance of very compelling VR and AR technology because it's been very clunky and silly up until now. And so it's no question why you don't want to walk around in Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse without legs, right? I mean, clearly we're not there yet, but I think it's actually on the verge of being something really astonishing. And if I can sit in my living room and it transforms into a completely immersive environment in which I'm either on stage with a symphony or in a play, or in a film, I think that's going to be a massive disruptor that will finally bring digital and sort of the experiential together in a way that's really compelling. So I would say watch for that, which is not going to help with a lot of the problems we just talked about trying to solve in this episode. But
could we charge a premium?
Could we be in two places at once?
Yes.
For the first time? Yeah, we could.
So, and charge a premium for it. So there you go.
That's right. Charge for it. You got it.
Oh, look at us solving the world in the last 2 minutes of a podcast. Well done.
This is really fun, Sue. Thank you. Yeah.
This has been so much fun. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Is there anything else? Parting words?
No, I just think, you know, it can often seem very doom and gloom, but we have to recognize we've been carving out a really important, potent space in society in this sector for a long time. And there's a lot of change right now, but let's try to think about how that disruption can create opportunity rather than feel like the world's against us. I really do not see this going away anytime soon in terms of creative practice and creativity being just vital to everyone having a wonderful existence. So I'm along for the ride here and happy to help anybody that wants to talk about that.
Excellent ending. Thank you so much.
Right on.
All right. This has been Ben and Sue talking about the state of the world and the arts and money. Everyone have a great day.
Thank you, Sue.
And that wraps up our 10th edition of At the Mic, au micro, a podcast of Arts Consultants Canada. For information on ACCA and our members, please check us out online at artsconsultants.ca. To send us feedback or questions on anything you hear in this podcast series, please email us at podcast@artsconsultants.ca. And remember to check out our show notes in this podcast for links mentioned during the program. Et notez bien que quelques épisodes sont en français et nous offrons accès à un service de traduction de ne rien manquer. Thank you so much for joining us on At the Mic. Remember to subscribe to this podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Until next time, and again, thanks for listening. À la prochaine!